Madam Speaker, in any country, general elections have lessons for both the victor and the vanquished. It is a time for a new beginning, and the first budget is an excellent opportunity to reflect this new thinking, to ponder the new direction, to reconceptualize and to redirect. A government that was in office for 30 years lost an election and remained in the wilderness for 10 years has the opportunity to reflect on its previous tenure of 30 years and undoubtedly the period that it survived in opposition. Likewise, the political party who once led a government for 10 years and has been vanquished has reason to reflect over its 10 years, learn the lessons of that period, and press ahead. The question that inevitably arises is this: what really is new in this budget? Does it reflect this new thinking, new thrust, new direction? And in a sense, it is that document that we must pay attention to, because it is really the first authoritative statement of what lies ahead and where we need to go. I won't give my own verdict on this, Madam Speaker, but I am sure emerge at some point. But there is an issue, Madam Speaker, that will need to be resolved early. It is this: what really is the record for this debate? Is it the written text before us, the budget statement, or is it what was uttered by the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance? You see, Madam Speaker, this is not something to be dismissed, and I believe that the situation would be helped when the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance, in his winding up, clarifies what precisely is the record. It is true, Madam Speaker, that the Honourable Minister for Finance indicated that his mind wanders from time to time. It is true. But that is not a point that anyone should latch on to. Rather, it is the fact that that written budget, based on the copy that I received on the night of the debate, contains pronouncements which were not made in his presentation that have significance for economic policy and economic direction institutions. May I, Madam Speaker, take you to pages 34 and 35? It may not match the text before you. But there is a statement of the national ownership of hotels and tourism facilities. I have no recollection that that statement was made. It says, Madam Speaker, lip service has been paid for a long time to the need to ensure that St. Lucians benefit directly from tourism and have ownership of hotels and tourism establishments within our country. The time has come for us to do more to ensure that this happens than today. I announced that with immediate effect, investments in hotels below an internationally recognized four-star standard will be reserved for St. Lucia nationals, and that incentives will not be granted to foreign nationals to invest in such properties. Investment incentives to foreign nationals will not be reserved for those projects that are designed to achieve an internationally recognized four-star standard and above, and that can add value to our tourism product by moving it towards the upper end of the tourism market. This is a serious policy pronouncement, and the Prime Minister in his delivery, the Honourable Minister for Finance, did not speak the language contained in this document. Therefore, I ask, what really is the record? What is the policy? It is a serious statement because it raises issues as to what do we tell telecom investors who have invested in this country, in the tourism sector? What do we tell external investors? Are they now only to invest in five-star hotels? What are we saying to the Jamaican investors at the hotel Coconut Bay in Newport? What are we saying to Armand, who has just purchased another hotel in the north? Because that hotel is cast in the marketplace as a four-star and below. There is another example at page 55. Plan on national security. Importantly for this administration, and as part of an innovative approach to crime reduction, we will embark this year upon a program that will see the progressive phasing in of CCTV cameras at specific public locations island-wide, which for the time being and for obvious reasons will remain undisclosed. Some might be tempted to say that we are taking spying on St. Lucians to the level. Some might be tempted to say that. Again, it is a serious policy pronouncement, and we need clarification as to whether this is in progress and it is really going to be done. I am aware, Madam Speaker, that the Commissioner of Police has repeatedly championed the need for CCTV cameras in certain places in this country. Then at page 58, again, and I'm using examples, Madam Speaker, there are several examples. In the middle of the page, Madam Speaker, we must raise the level of self-worth of our vulnerable populations. In this fiscal year, this administration will therefore undertake the necessary research with a view to introducing minimum wage legislation. Clearly, whoever wrote this budget speech is unaware that there is new minimum wage legislation. There is minimum legislation. The issue is not enactment of minimum legislation. And again, what needs to be clarified is whether the Honourable Prime Minister intends to abandon the existing minimum wage legislation and proceed to enact new minimum legislation. More to the point again, Madam Speaker, and I'll use this as a very last example because this is not a matter I wish to belabor. But it has administrative consequences. Review of administration of firearm licenses, page 67. Madam Speaker, present firearm licenses are to be paid every 3 years. This arrangement has, however, posed problems as the keeping of records by the police is made more difficult than if an annual payment requirement existed. Also, Madam Speaker, it is easier for owners of firearms to develop the habit of paying licenses annually. Accordingly, the payment of firearm licenses on an annual basis will be reinstituted with effect from May 2, 2007. The cost to the owners of firearms will remain unchanged so that instead of paying a fee of $300 for 3 years, the license fee would be $100 annually. Again, there was no statement from the Honorable Prime Minister, despite the fact that this is contained. This obviously has serious consequences, because farm owners would need to know how soon they should proceed and on what basis to renew their licenses. But unfortunately, and this is the problem, and I shall be brief on this, the logic is intriguing, fascinating, incomprehensible, because it is well known that data on farm licenses are usually kept by the Inland Revenue Department. What really is the problem? We are not told. But again, I want to urge the Honorable Minister of Finance to go through that budget speech and all those areas which understandably he did not pronounce on to indicate authoritatively whether these are areas of policy and what precisely is the position on these statements. Already some of these statements are reproduced in national newspapers, taken as gospel, yet one is unclear precisely where we stand on these issues. But allow me, Madam Speaker, to touch briefly on the inheritance of this government. I've heard insults. I've heard the mepui. I've heard the abuse. I take it. It's expected. A first budget after a general election. It's understood. Whether that is how our democracy should progress is a different matter. But there can be no question about it that this successor government, led by the Prime Minister, inherited an economy in reasonably good shape. Debt notwithstanding. The key indicators jump at you. 5.4% GDP growth rate following 4 years of solid growth. 0.81 in 2002. 2.92 in 2003. 4.58 in 2004. And 4.59 in 2005. And then, of course, the statistics that aroused the ire of the Minister of Agriculture and the member for Babineau. 9.8% expansion in agriculture, led by 11.4% growth in the banana sector. 16.7% increase in fish landings, thanks to the fishermen of Beaufort. 6.7% increase in manufacturing. 13.2% expansion in the construction sector. All of these statistics in the National Economic Report. On the fiscal side, 10.2% improvement in current revenue, increasing the current surplus from 78.8 million in 2005-2006 to 101.1 million in 2006-2007. A contribution of $30 million in surplus revenue to capital expenditure. And see the estimates at page 533, where that is admitted. And the promise of reducing inflation. This successor government inherited an inflation rate of 2.3%, in contrast to the ravaging inflation rates in Trinidad and Tobago and Barbados. But yet, amidst everything, amidst all the criticisms, there is that crowning achievement adverted to by members on this side. The crowning achievement in the reduction of the unemployed to 13.7%, at the end of the fourth quarter of 2006. This is the lowest unemployment rate recorded in St. Lucia since the statistical department started measuring unemployment in 1992. Why don't you ignore it and give it credit and say to yourself that we inherited an unemployment rate of 13.6%. Our responsibility for the children of the future is to take it down to 10%. But you can't be gracious. My response. The Minister of Finance can jump high. He can jump low. He can somersault. He can twist and turn. He can do all those things. But whether he likes it or not, the SLP government achieved the lowest unemployment rate in St. Lucia since 1992. As usual, in victory we don't know how to be gracious and magnanimous. Perhaps you may have learned from us in our time. You may have. But that is besides the point. You cannot be gracious. He says, and it is parroted, quote, "It was an artificial spike created by steps for election purposes. Madam Speaker, the unemployment statistics in this country are on the government website. They are published by the Statistics Department. And I do recall an exchange we had in your other life on that issue. But tell me, any reasonable person, no matter what the dislike may be for steps, the statistics say that in the first quarter of 2004, there were 55,880 St. Lucians employed. And I'm quoting from the Statistical Department. By the end of the fourth quarter in 2005, it rose to 68,914. And by the fourth quarter, it rose in 2006, it rose to 76,020. Now, this means that in fact, the Statistics Department is reporting that between the period 2004, beginning and the end of 2006, there were 21,000 additional jobs. Now, how on earth steps could conceivably explain 21? If you want, you can attack the statistics. But even here, you must display a certain probity. You can't shout net statistics each time it favors the opposition and then proceed to glorify without more statistics with appears to denigrate the opposition. You cannot have it both ways. And of course I understand all of this. I understand the distortion. I understand the failure for us to come to terms. We have a country to govern. We have a country to manage. We need to make a start, and to do so, we must start on the existing factual basis. What really is the inheritance? Attacking Kenny Anthony, calling him all kinds of names, don't resolve that. It does not resolve that. It is true that it brings you face to face with the reality of your own campaign, because in your manifesto of 2006, you said at page 18, at present, approximately 20% of the workforce is unemployed. That's what you said at page 18. You are wrong. They said so. It turned out to be patently false. Admit it. Move on and forget. But the problem, Madam Speaker, is that this budget reeks of deceit and it does not make the start that the country needs. It reeks of broken promises. It is constructed on the foundation of deceit. How can you introduce an annual license of $100 but say it is not a tax but a method of control? The Minister of Communications and Works has sought to justify why the $100 is necessary. And I will share experience with him on this matter because we face the identical problem. But you cannot tell the people of St. Lucia it is not a tax because it is known that any compulsory monetary contribution to the state's revenue assessed and imposed by a government on the activities, on the enjoyment, expenditure, income, occupation, privilege, property, etc. of any individual organization is a tax. That's the definition of a tax. And I'm sure that a member for some central Castries who is familiar with points of law will tell you that that is the basic position of a court. Why then do you go and justify it as an administrative measure for purposes of control? According to the estimates of expenditure, or the estimates of recurrent revenue, the government of St. Lucia is expected to rake in an increase of about $3 million from licenses. In fact, let me be a little specific. It's on page 6, I think. Licenses, the revised estimate for 2006-2007 is $3,031,000. It now climbs to $9,532. I said, Madam Speaker, that look, there's times you need to share experience for what is worth. Of course, it can be criticized, economics. Criticized. But we face the identical problem in 98. And I want to tell the Minister of Communications and Works that no matter how sweet the logic appears, you will continue to have a problem because the regime was in place in 98-99. Before the measure was introduced and altered in 1998, this is what I said in the budget address. I'm quoting Madam Speaker, budget address, 1998-99, page 27. Consider the following statistics. In 1995, of the 31,031 vehicles registered, an estimated 13,400 or 43.1% paid licenses. 56% didn't pay. In 1996, the number of vehicles on the register fell to 24,857, presumably because of more efficient record keeping. Of that number, licenses were paid for 14,452 vehicles, or 58.1%. In 1997, the number of registered vehicles increased to 27,697, and licenses were paid for only 15,637, that is 56.4%. Solve your problem. If you believe that imposing the licenses will solve your problem, then these statistics are telling you, you had those licenses in place one time, it did not solve the problem, because people have a natural resistance to meeting their obligations on these matters, and asking them to present their life insurances, their motor vehicle insurances, will not help. But we must also consider whether we want to reimpose the administrative cost, the delay, the time that ordinary solution citizens will have to face marching up to the licensing office to simply pay an annual private license. Do you really want those things? You're not interested in efficiency anymore. Is that what we want? Could we have found an alternative approach to deal with these matters rather than what is obviously a simple solution to a serious problem, admittedly? But you know, again, I'm going to want to share the experience of the Labour government with this environmental levy matter. What was the promise? Abolish this hated tax. Abolish the environmental levy. That was the promise. Reality? Keep the environmental levy. Refashion it, but deny citizens the right of importation if the vehicle is 5 years old, 5 years and over. More than 5 years, if you will. I'm uninterested in theatrics today. No time for that today. But time and time again, we struggle our memories. Because there's an issue here. How well we remember the platforms, the repeated statements. Yes, I do remember the dance. I do remember the dance. Naturally. And how well we remember the member for Central Castries in his advertisements regarding this environmental levy. Better yet, of course, the Star newspaper reporting on the town hall meeting where the member for Central Castries, I think, starred in a report by Matthew Hunt. Question directed to the honorable member, and he was honorable member. The government has imposed many taxes on the backs of our people. If the UWD comes to office, will they remove these taxes? Matthew Hunt paraphrases, I believe, says, maybe direct words, the answer. Answer. Oh, of course. I have had a conversation with the John, telling him that our people have a burden with the 12,000 environmental on imported and new vehicles. It's unnecessary. And if, not when, and he's correct about that surely, we assume of it, I promise in Lucian this tax will be removed. Well, Sir John did not listen. Sir John did not take your advice. It has not been removed. It is refashioned. Should I then say, good for you, Sir John. Good for you, reality check. Do you finally understand? You finally understand that we had a problem on our hands and we had to deal with it. But we lack the courage to tell our people that. We simply lacked the courage to tell our people that. What is the vital difference? I want to indicate that the SLP government first started off by prohibiting the importation of used cars, I believe, over 4 years old. But it did not work. It did not work for good reason. and the former Minister of Commerce will tell you why. Despite the fact that the message was loud and clear that you would not allow cars over 4 years old to come into the country, there were St. Lucians who said that when they imported, they never knew about this, pleading ignorance of the law. That when they ordered the car, the specs they got told them that the car was 3 years old within the prohibition. But when they arrived and they checked customs check, they discovered that the car was more than 3 years old. What this policy means is that you are going to be overwhelmed by requests by ordinary institutions telling you that they did not know or that they were misled at the point of importation. I'm simply saying that if you are going to take that route, then you have a duty to put into place a mechanism that will not allow persons to import those cars over 5 years old. And I want you to think very carefully the impact of the logic. After that experience, the SNP government decided, look, we will concede the right to import vehicles because we did have a serious philosophical problem over this issue. We will concede the right, but put the fee at a rate and a level that would suggest to the purchaser of those vehicles, be wary, that is not the best course to follow. Because we felt that the right was more important than the curtailment. You have gone the other way. You have gone back to what we had. But I am not so sure whether the average purchaser is going to be any better off. And I don't have the answers, I don't have the statistics. But again, I say it is one of those issues that we need to reflect on and think about. When you stop or prohibit the importation of vehicles over 5 years old, you are compelling persons to buy more expensive vehicles falling within the bracket of 1 to 2 years. Sorry, 1 to 5 years. These are more expensive vehicles. They are higher end. They are higher end vehicles coming in at greater cost. And therefore, when you add the environmental levy to that greater cost, I don't know. I don't have the statistics. But these are things we need to think, because you are changing consumer taste and directing consumer taste. But is this issue of the VAT prior to the general election, and in several statements I made publicly or otherwise, I suggested that it would be wise for the opposition and the government to get together to speak on this issue of taxation, to speak on this issue of VAT, to speak on the issue of tax reform, to see if we can get a common position. I even suggested that it would be a wise thing for us to have debate between us on the whole issue of taxation during the campaign, but I was ignored. I guess it was felt to be very unnecessary. But again, promise and reality. The promise to the public at large, no introduction of VAT. It is SLP's plan to introduce VAT, despite the protests of the SLP, but by then, who is listening? Who cares? But that is the reality. That is what you told the electorate. And now we have this conundrum. This intellectual conundrum. Would it not have been better if the Honorable Prime Minister had said, look, we have to carry this country forward, we need to make adjustments in our taxation system, we have the WTO breathing down our necks. Mercifully, the FTA has now shifted to the horizon. Our WTO commitments require us to make adjustments in our indirect taxation system. We are under pressure because of the service charge. Because when we signed on to the WTO prior to 1997, we did not ask for any dispensation regarding some of those taxes. And that's been the problem. Other countries in the region did, but we did not. No derogation. It was your fault. You signed. Don't ask a foolish question. Amen. We never made an issue of it. If the Honorable Prime Minister had said to the opposition in this budget, forget the vitriol. I don't know whether he can help it or not, but forget it. And say to the opposition, we have a problem. In your statement, you warned St. Lucia's in your budget address in 2005-2006, or 2006-2007, that the tax system had to be reformed. Would you agree that we meet and discuss this issue to see whether a common position could evolve? I recall when the tax commissioners reported, I specifically requested them to hold meetings with the opposition on this issue to get a point of view from the opposition, not because I had any desire to compromise them, because I knew that down the line we had to face the issue of reforming our tax system because it had become regressive. But again, the logic. Campaign, UWP will not introduce that. Kenyans did not have the will to introduce that. Now, I will impose that, never mind what we said during the campaign. Promise and reality juxtaposed and a nakedness exposed. For the record, I want to say as follows. The SLP government was never convinced that that was the right way to go. Never. We never took a decision on that. You will never see any record that we agreed to that. Indeed, we never gave the Monetary Council any commitment to VAT, and the reason, among others, was simply this, that we also felt that the Monetary Council had no business in fiscal policy. It was the wrong forum. But we didn't oppose the study, but we made that position clear. We never gave the tax commissioners any commitment to introduce VAT. We just listened to them. You may ask why at this stage, because we are involved, Madam Speaker, in preliminary skirmishes on this issue, because there is no bill yet before us to impose that or to introduce that, whichever language you prefer. That will come, according to the Honorable Prime Minister, later this year. So there will be enough time to debate it. But why was it that we never came to a position on it? It's unfaithful. We were never persuaded that that was the wisest choice, because we believe that it is potentially an oppressive tax. It is oppressive to the poor, it is oppressive to workers, and wherever VAT has been introduced, yes, contrary to what the member for Miku says, you may get a windfall in the first couple of years, but one thing is certain, your retail prices jump, especially the price of food. St. Lucia, despite what you say to us, what we say to you, the unmistakable fact is that the cost of living in St. Lucia is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, in the OECD. That is why they come and shop here. That is why when the Antiguans come down, no matter what the problems may be with a monopoly called Super J, they go there and buy cheese to take back. That's reality. But the Honorable Minister of Finance is proceeding again on the wrong footing. He is proceeding on the wrong footing. Because he says, among other things, that will remove the nuisance taxes. And he quotes and cites the income tax term. Obviously, whoever wrote that speech is not up to date, because the income tax clearance was abolished by this government since 1998. Nobody has to go and pay for an income tax clearance. They have the freedom of movement since 1998. The only persons who have to get a tax exit certificate to pay for it are non-nationals who don't work permits for good reason. What we need to do, and what you need to do, is to check the record and check the record carefully. Every country where VAT has been introduced has experienced a spiral in food prices. Some tell you it is because of imperfect introduction, not properly targeted. And when our Honorable Minister for Finance tells us that you are going to introduce VAT that is revenue neutral, don't be so disingenuous. Why introduce a tax that is revenue neutral? All of us know the sole reason why you have to introduce VAT is not only to spread what you call the burden, and we will come to that in due course, but most importantly to raise additional revenue. That's the bottom line. That's what the tax commissioner said. What revenue neutrality you're talking about? It's naked taxation to raise additional revenue. But as I said, the time will come to debate back. The time will come when the Minister of Finance will have to tell the nation his position on a few things. Where that is concerned, whether the consumers of water will have to pay VAT on their water bills as in Barbados, Jamaica, and elsewhere. You will have to tell the consumers of electricity whether in addition to their electricity bills, they have to pay the VAT as exists in the other islands. You will have to tell St. Lucians whether at every restaurant in this country, whether in Rodney Bay, in Castries, in Miku, in Beaufort, in Labrie, whether each time someone buys a sandwich or a meal, that they have to pay VAT on that sandwich or a meal. The time will come too. Whether you will explain to every market vendor, each time they sell an item, whether to tourists or locals, that they have to charge VAT and remit the VAT to the government of St. Lucia. That's the sort of reality that we have to face. That is the sort of music that you have to face in this issue. And don't bob and weave. Face it. And stop blaming me for not introducing it so that you can benefit from it. You want to introduce VAT? Introduce it. But don't look to the opposition and use them as your scapegoat. But now that figure, this budget is so interesting. It is so interesting. There's one outstanding feature of this budget. It is that it has decided to postpone St. Lucia to the future. It has condemned St. Lucia to tomorrow. It has offered to tell us what will be done, interestingly, about our hills, our valleys. Suddenly, the people of St. Lucia have disappeared from the radar. The Minister of Finance has declined to tell us how he intends to sustain growth after Cricket World Cup, because he described it as a party. And how can we forget those words? What will happen when the party is over? But you haven't told us. You haven't told us what will happen when the party is over and how you're going to manage it. What are the policies which will be pursued to sustain growth and to reduce unemployment? What are the specific economic programs and policies? Is it a policy to sustain this economy in the next 2 years through tax reform and construction? And yet, you speak about new production in agriculture. I would have thought that you would have explained to us how you're going to address the downturn in tourism. What precisely are you going to do? Are we going to pay airlines to fly into St. Lucia? Which airlines we are going to pay and why? What amount we are going to pay to these airlines? Are we now going to see subsidizing tourists come into this country? Can we afford to do this when our marketing budget is comprised of loans and a so-called grant this year? Is it sustainable for us that we have a marketing program financed largely on borrowing? These are the questions which the budget needed to answer. Alas, alas, there is no help. But let's look to the estimate. Comment, reality. We juxtapose again. We juxtapose again. And at the meet, at the commencement of this debate, I said to honorable members in all humility, take it, leave it, that we all have to learn the bitter lesson of politics. We need to grow. We need to develop. That's what we have to do. Learn from our mistakes. And we have to learn that it is fatal to make promises to an electorate that is becoming increasingly sophisticated, promises that we cannot keep. We know that the promises are farcical. Promise, the manifesto says, in familiar language to you, on its cover page, eliminate financial management and waste of public funds, thereby reducing government's annual recurrent expenditure by 300 million. And the Minister of Finance, in his presentation, said that he knows he's going to be excoriated on that point. And if he's excoriated, then there is good reason. That was a promise. But that's not all. You would have thought that after being in office for about 4 to 5 months and you've seen the finances of the country, you would not have said the kind of thing you said to Pete Minzal on DBS on Friday, March 23rd. And it's a quote from the Minister of Finance. Quote, we are preparing for the budget, but it's not easy. Not an easy task. We have been working on it for over 2 months and we still can't get it together. It's not just about spending on big projects here and there. We also have to save. And to save, we must cut expenditure. We have to cut expenditure. And to do this, we have to look at the size of the public service. It's too large. we have to do something about it. And Madam Speaker, to affect it, I'll be happy to make it a document of the House. Most happy to do so.
Honourable Leader of the Opposition, you have 10 minutes to the next complete presentation.
Madam Speaker, I would like to invoke Standing Order 32 to allow the Honourable Leader of the Opposition an additional 60 minutes. 60 minutes.
Madam Speaker, I beg to move a counter motion that the Standing Order 32A be suspended to allow the Leader of the Opposition an additional 30 minutes.
Honourable members, the question is that Standing Order 32A be suspended to allow the Honourable Leader of the Opposition an additional 30 minutes within which to complete his presentation. I now put the question, as many as are of the opinion, say aye. As many as are of the contrary opinion, say no.
No.
I think the ayes have it.
Division,
class. Position, you have been granted an additional 30 minutes, making a total of 40 minutes within which to complete the presentation.
Madam Speaker, don't take this. But let me say this. If this government believes by seeking to silence me, they're cutting me down to size. You are not hurting me. You're hurting the democracy of this country. Because what you did today has never happened in this house when you're in office. But time will tell.
You'll be there forever.
To return.
You'll be there forever, man. You'll never be there.
I want to turn to the budget address of the Honorable Prime Minister at pages 69 to 70. I want to turn to pages 69 to 70.
If I have something else.
Philip, please. Please. Leave that alone. Leave it. Madam Speaker, control of the recurrent expenditure is one of the principal economic management priorities of this administration. During the recent election campaign, Madam Speaker, it was made clear that a United Worker Party administration would give priority to the reduction of recurrent expenditure as a means of making more of the nation's revenue available for financing of the capital program. Madam Speaker, honorable members, changing the direction of a country is like altering the course of an ocean liner. It takes time. Quote, lower down, for the first time in years, recurrent expenditure has been reduced below the level of the preceding year. And over the next few budgets, this process will continue until we have eliminated all wasteful and unproductive expenditure. That's a statement. Now, promise, reality. In 2006-2007, the approved estimates for recurrent expenditure was $700 million and $60,015. The revised estimates for 2006 is $695,688,003. The recurrent expenditure as represented by the revised estimate is $4,372,012 lower. That is the real figure for any serious analysis to determine whether there has been any reduction in recurrent expenditure. But the Minister of Finance has already indicated that he was only able to reduce 4 million. And the contention is that he did nothing to reduce 4 million. It is simply that recurrent expenditure was less than that forecast, and it was a natural process. Indeed, he says it is for the first time in years. If you look at the estimate for 2005-2006, look at the estimates for 2005-2006, the comparative summary of recurrent expenditure, the approved estimate was $618,480,241. The revised estimate, what was actually spent for recurrence, was $604,876,093. Normal. And you go through nearly every estimate for any year, you will see these reductions. In effect, the Minister of Finance is proposing a recurrent expenditure for 2007-2008 of $696,500,000. And if we have to take the base figure of $695,688,003, then it means that he's increasing recurrent expenditure by $811,997. That's the reality, no reduction. Just actually increased it as of now over the real figure, the real expenditure. Of course, maybe we'll have to wait and see how many other civil servants lose their jobs, because I shall come to that in a minute. I was tempted, Madam Speaker, tempted to label, but I'm not going to do that. I will refrain from doing that. But it's interesting. The Minister of Finance targets the rentals as one area, and I agree. I actually agree. And I agree because the Labour government had proposed that we should consider constructing a new building for government offices precisely because of the problem that had been raised. The challenge, obviously, was finding the correct location, finding the correct site. And we were so persuaded to move in that direction because we also knew that if you got the correct site and you raised that same loan, then thousands of solutions could be employed in constructing such a building, helping to further reduce unemployment. Indeed, there was even talk that it made eminent sense that some of the CDCs in central Castries be abandoned, that the persons living there be given new housing elsewhere and concede that place to a new government complex. But this is the time for you to show an example. And I understand that the premises of Cox & Company has to be acquired for a new office, new building. Is that so? Why are we not sure? Why are you not showing an example for the very same evil that you are attempting to crucify others for? I will say nothing now about the proposal to purchase the De Gea building. I shall leave that for later. It is fishy. I will keep on smelling it for the time being, and it will rest there. Now, if the Minister of Finance increases recurrent expenditure, if he has been in office for the last 4 months and did not succeed in reducing recurrent expenditure, and note the emphasis is on recurrent expenditure, it must mean that the claims about wastage in the public service was grossly exaggerated. It has no foundation in fact. That is why you could not reduce it. And that is why the only way you can reduce it is to fire public officers, reduce the size of the public service, which I shall never support. That's the reality. On the recurrent side, despite all the abuse and attacks on the SSB, including myself, the reality is that the SLP administration managed a tight ship when it came to recurrent expenditure. That is the reality. Otherwise, we'd have been able to reduce it. And immediately achieved a 10 million reduction, it would have been substantial. But you couldn't do anything about it. Look at you, look at you, look at you, Rochamel, look at you, Rochamel, Rochamel. Get lost in Rochamel. But what about capital expenditure? What about capital expenditure? Fascinating. Many years ago, I recall that when the now Minister for National Development, Senator Osbert Bruvaeng, was the Permanent Secretary, he devised a system of regional administration. He divided the country into regions and decided to establish what he called regional offices. It floundered. It failed. So now in 2007, we have the quadrant approach to development. We have the quadrant philosophy. We have quadrant economics. You divide the country into quadrants and you assign to each an economic function or an economic activity. Frankly, in some ways, this quadrant approach of philosophy can be likened to what the Labour Party was accused of and derided about many years ago, centrally planned economies, central planning, central planned economies. They say the Labour Party was fascinated with that in the 70s and the 80s. In fact, during the 1970s and 80s, the St. Lucia Labour Party had been accused of wanting to adopt its very approach to development of St. Lucia. The proposals envisaged the creation of new economic spaces where the type of economic activity will vary across 5 major geographic regions. The suggestion is that every geographic region can only be allocated to one major type of economic activity. That's the new tomorrow. That's the new tomorrow. This type of thinking is precisely what led to the unbalanced approach to development during the 1980s. Where tourism investment was concentrated in the north while the rest of the country was committed to agriculture. And when the bottom caved in and bananas got into trouble, then those communities almost collapsed because they were dependent on a single economic activity. Now, what is the difference in approach? What is the difference in approach? We believe that it is vital in a developing economy that you look for mixed opportunities And it is precisely for that reason that the former administration invested so heavily in trying to bring about the planning development on stream, in trying to persuade our farmers in the south that we must give way to a tourism development project in Black Bay and in time in canals. It wasn't a question of seeking to root out agricultural farmers because we gave them options, but because it was vital that we diversify the economy. And today the people of Prale, when that hotel is completed, the Minister of Agriculture will have the opportunity to build the forward and backward linkages between that hotel and the agricultural sector. Now, I don't need to write you the same movie. But let me say this. I remember when that hotel was announced. The people of St. Lucia were sold all kinds of things. All our shares in it. It went even further to suggest that I fooled the people of this country by getting the builders to scrape the land to suggest that there was going to be a building on that hotel. Today, this government, the ruling party, is a beneficiary of a project which this government has worked very hard to bring about. But I want to caution that we need to think very carefully as we seek to implement this notion of development by quadrants, because there are inherent dangers in this kind of approach. But it is the allocation of capital expenditure that is interesting, Madam Speaker. It's an interesting order of allocation, and I really am fascinated. When I looked at this summary, Madam Speaker, the summary of allocation of capital expenditure, when I looked at it, this is a picture that emerged. At page 509. The Ministry of Economic Affairs, Economic Planning, National Development and the Public Service, in short, the ministry managed by Senator Drogai, had the bulk of the capital expenditure assigned to him, $123,806,688. He was followed by the Ministry of Communications, a handsome $95,089,000. The Ministry of Tourism following with $54.3 million. The Ministry of Agriculture, $43.3 million, made up largely of CBEX and the EU funds. And the Ministry of Finance, $39.5 million. The others follow. What this Minister of Finance has done is to trust the lion's share of the capital budget to Senator Osbert Dovey. Not only is he unelected, but really, how could the Minister of Finance trust donor funds to an individual who has in the past abused the trust of a donor agency? Unless, he stopped me, Madam Speaker, there is a report of the Commission of Inquiry by the UWP administration. There is the report of the Blum Cooper inquiry pointing out that he used his offices to reward himself unjustifiably. But you are trusting a capital budget and assigning to him $123.8 million. You do not expect donors to be concerned about this. But you know, What is even more alarming is to identify specific programs. Mirrors keep on flashing about programs. Can't do that. Yes, you provided some details, bare details, from which it is difficult to call the precise programs and activities that will come from the several items. Look at Project 18205 in the estimates. Look at Project 19206 in the estimates. 21208, 22209, what are the specifics of these projects? What are the specific programs that emerge from these projects? Is he to determine these projects at his whim, reward who he wants in your cabinet? And it is pointless saying to us that you're not going to tell us which roads are going to be developed because you don't want members to begin to quarrel. That's not leadership, you know better. It is the people of this country that matter. They must be told what you want to do and how you're going to do it. But most intriguing are the sources of financing. I have never heard such silence in my life. I have never heard such silence. You know, when you look at the sources of financing for the capital budget, it is stated that the PRC, and when you look at what it means, the People's Republic of China, they will be financing $104,213,674 of that capital budget. Yet, not a word to this honorable house. What does this portend? What does it mean? Of course, you might well want to tell us that you obtained this through your skill. I would reply to you, yes, you have obtained this through your skill, but it is diplomatic extortion. That's what it is. That is what it is. So you know what is sad? You say, Honorable Minister of Finance, your members say, we try to say. We are a gracious people. We have had a history of knowing how to say thank you. But why continue the insult? Forget for a moment that you did not wish to state openly that you had arrived at a position on this diplomatic fiasco. But if you're going to introduce a capital budget and one donor is contributing $104 million, surely the people of St. Lucia needed to be told. But no. You tell them that they're building white elephants in this country. That's what you tell them. And indeed, I well recall, that on March 24th, the day on which the Honorable Prime Minister met the Foreign Minister of Taiwan, the Minister of Health, the Honorable Stevenson King, toured the mental hospital facility with the Chinese ambassador. Radio St. Lucia reported him as saying the hospital is, quote, a masterpiece of a facility that will transform psychiatric treatment in this country. I concur. And I agree with Minister Stevenson. Yet, our Prime Minister, while the facility is under construction, is saying to the Chinese, you are building a white elephant. And to compound it, it is said in this parliament, you're building a white elephant we can't maintain. You mean to tell me, in all sincerity, that we can find money to build a tunnel through the bad illness, and I shall come to that shortly, and we cannot handle the maintenance of a psychiatric hospital? Are we to keep the patients of that psychiatric hospital in that mess they're in? Have a little compassion. But there are unexplained things, too, about the capital estimate, for which you owe the house an explanation. $16 million is to be derived from the sale of assets. Which government assets are being sold? What do you intend to sell? If it is those who are sold, then of course you'll have all the time in the world in your reply to say so. Interestingly, some $41,393,170 is programmed to be provided by the Kuwaiti Fund. Now this is interesting. But things have changed. It is my understanding that the Kuwaiti Fund, the same fund that has been excoriated in respect of the funds provided for that highway, and I'll come to that at some point, not today. It is my understanding that they normally make $10 million available per country, per project, per year. How then do we get this $41 million? And is this going to be a new loan for 1 year? Surely, we need to clarify. But distinguished Minister of Finance, whatever may be said about you, your legacy, your history, your habits, whatever, there's one thing about you is that you have a passion for the arts. Yeah, credit you with that. But come on. Come on. You know, as I know, as the Minister of External Affairs know, that the People's Republic of China, in a memorandum signed with the government of Sipuja, included as part of the package of assistance to Sipuja the construction of a national theater. We went as far as to invite the Cultural Development Foundation to begin the process of preparing an architectural brief for this project. Indeed, my instruction to them at the time was to dialogue with our Nobel laureate, with Honorable Derek Walcott, as much as possible, because I was anxious that whatever emerged truly reflected what he believed was the way to go. The People's Republic of China have had a history, and they have been faithful to every single agreement that they have made. They started off with the Free Zone Complex, moved on to the stadium, then moved on to the psychiatric hospital, and the fourth project was the National Theater Complex. I understand, and I'm a politician just like you, that from time to time we make pronouncements in public. And you made a pronouncement at the school rally after watching the dances and the rest of it. I think you are smitten by the quality of what you saw. And then you announced that you're going to contribute $1 million for National Theatre. So, all of this will hinge on whether you decide to throw out the Chinese or whether you decide to introduce the Taiwanese or not. That's the reality. But let me say this, for goodness sake, whatever you do, make sure that whoever is funding you after the process is completed, that they meet that obligation which the People's Republic of China agreed that they would meet. Because we are talking not of a facility of $5 million, we are talking of a facility of $40-50 million. That's what they were going to build for the people of the nation. But you know, the Minister of Finance, in a moment of levity in his presentation, I have to credit him, he took it well. On that occasion, he did admit that he has a passion for tunnels. He did admit that he has a tunnel vision. And it provided a rare opportunity of levity in what otherwise was a rambling presentation lacking in focus. But I would ask him in all sincerity, given the proclivities to constructing tunnels, why are you interfering with an ecologically sensitive area as Badaloo? Is a tunnel really necessary through the Badaloo? Think rationally. Do we really need to interfere with the Badaloo? Is there anything blatantly wrong with this, with the road that leads now to an ecotourism site? I'll be true, you will have the occasional landslide. But you know, we have reached the point where we have to treat this environment of ours carefully. We have to treat it with sensitivity. We cannot continue to leave scars on our environment. Yes, the tunnel road was needed. Yes, it has helped to alleviate traffic. Yes, it has allowed for new buildings and new developments. Yes, it has enriched the people who own land along that way. Yes, we are able to build two hospitals. But there is no question that it has scarred that area. And I'm not even so sure, possibly like you, how stable that entire area may be in the long term. But don't try that with the hospitals, because we'll reply, there is no such study about any such hospital. There is no such study which says that the site is unstable. And the Minister of Health can begin to flash documents if he wishes. But let me return to what I said originally. As politicians, all of us have our passions, all of us have our dreams, all of us have our vision. Some people have dreams and passion to see the development of people. Other persons have passion and vision and dreams about buildings. But we have reached that point where we have to treat our environment with care and sensitivity. I want to illustrate.
Honorable Leader of the Opposition, you have 10 moments to
complete
your presentation.
I want to illustrate. There are persons sitting in this honorable house who remember what Central Cass Street looked like 30 years ago. Much has changed. Much has changed 30 years ago. And the changes... The changes, Madam Speaker, are reflected in all kinds of things. But there was something in Castries that added a special character. That was Prince Alfred Basin. And that is where the Christmas and New Year cultural activities used to take place. Aquatic sports, if you want to use more sophisticated language, to which I credit you. Aquatic sports, he said. But what happened? 35 years ago, the Prime Minister, in his earlier life, decided that the ports of Castries needed to be modernized, and despite protests, backfilled Prince Alfred Basin put on those huge, ugly buildings on the wharf, and what has happened? 25, 30 years later, the buildings are useless because the technology changed to containerized cargo. The result, we have lost Prince Alfred Basin, a unique feature of Castries. Very, very unique. I want to make say to the Honorable Prime Minister that I am not seeking to score political points on this issue. There are no political points to score. All I'm saying is that think hard about carrying or defacing the barriers for the tunnel. There is one proposal in your budget that has the potential if you redirect it in my view. That is the suggestion that you want to construct a 26.5 kilometer road from La Caillinière in Denry to Louvette and Marquis Estate. Why explore two options? Indeed, the opposition would find comfort with this proposal because the opposition has always said that what we need to do is to construct a highway stretching from Grosjean along the East Coast linking back to the Denry Road. In other words, expand on this proposal. True, they're going to be environmental issues. True. But those environmental issues may be less challenging. Indeed, the Labour government had in fact commissioned a study to determine whether this was a feasible option when we were looking at options for a four-lane highway, and the consultants, who are not your favorite consultants, so you can resume the process if you wish, reported that it was premature to move in that direction because the number of vehicles did not justify that kind of investment, but that we need to look at it in another 10 years. Two questions, you know. Why explore both options? Why build a new terminal at GFL Charles Airport when the new roads are intended to assist in the utilization of excess capacity at Huanura Airport? Why? There are restrictions for jets. The FAA has imposed restrictions for jets for that airport. SRASPA has imposed restrictions that after 6 o'clock, jets are not to be entertained. Why do we want to do that? These things need to be thought out very carefully. Unfortunately, Madam Speaker, I don't have the time to deal with this that issue. Very unfortunately. Because of the fact that I have been denied the right as leader of this opposition to speak. I don't have the time to deal with it. If all of us want to see our democracy to be trampled in this manner, then so be it. I will seek another forum to deal with it. But before I make my departure, under the terms and conditions imposed by that government, there's one thing I want to say to the Minister of Agriculture on behalf of my constituents. Minister of Agriculture, for 2 months now, the fishermen of Beaufort have not been paid by the fisheries complex. There are fishermen in Beaufort who are owed as much as $50,000. $80,000, no, not from my time. For fish sold since you have been in office, and they haven't been paid. And if you want to find out, go and ask your henchmen in that area. You can ask them. I'm addressing the wrong ministry. I'm addressing you. I'm addressing the Minister of Finance.
The fishermen
require to be paid.
The Leader of the Opposition. Observations are to be addressed to the Speaker in all cases, not directly to members.
Is that a point of order? No, that's a direction. Okay, sorry.
That's a direction.
Yes, Madam Speaker. It is now 2 months that they have not been paid and they're languishing. 2 months. And to compound their difficulties and their problems, since this government has got into office, the price of fish has dropped, whereas fish was sold for $6-$7 a pound. Today they're being paid $5.50 a pound. Now, it is for you to decide whether it is deflation or not. But I can tell you that your own good friends are screaming, and the time has come to redress that situation, because it is that industry that sustains economic life in Beaufort. Now, here you go. Instead of being decent and say you're going to inquire, you want to cast aspersions. You talk about Guyana. The simple fact is that what the fishermen are owed today had nothing to do with when I was in office. It was incurred in the last few weeks. Go and ask Cooley. He'll tell you. That is his name. That is his name. He accepts that. It's not figurative language. It is his name. And that's how you deal with these problems. Madam Speaker, Prime Minister of this country, and I'm winding up, speaks about bridging the divide and rewriting and reuniting St. Lucia, forging one destiny by creating opportunities for all. I have another compliment to him. I have gone through all his budget addresses. This is the very first time that he has given his budget a theme. I'm glad he's done so. But apparently Kenyonomics, as he put it, seems to have had some influence, because he's now trying to rally his budget around themes. So this is the first time there has been a selected theme for an address. But I want to say to him, in all sincerity, that destroying mountains, removing physical barriers, building new access routes, cannot unite people. People are united in their hearts, in their souls, in their spirits. They're united in the comfort that if differences exist, there is tolerance for these differences because our democracy demands it. They're united when they know they're fairly treated, and their prerogatives are not wrongly taken away from them because of the tyranny of the majority. Protection of the minority is a cardinal rule in our system. The strength of a democracy depends on the protection of that minority. Unity can never be built on victimization. But what does this Prime Minister tell us? He tells us in Parliament. He tells us in Parliament that when we clean out the bureaucracy, do not shout victimization. That is what he said. That is what he said. He told the people of Sufficient. Madam Speaker, I made the point that we all have to learn our lessons from the electoral process. But you know what is sad? I will give you 6 names, Madam Speaker, today who have lost their jobs because people believe that they have political affiliation.
Honourable Leader of the Opposition, would you wind up after you've given those 6 names?
Absolutely, Madam Speaker. Today, Gilroy Sackney, who was Human Resource Manager Aslakpa presented me with a letter. A statutory board that he was dismissed, his contract terminated. Mikey Ferrer was deputy manager of Aslakpa, whose only sin was to be the son of George Frederick Charles. Mikey Ferrer has never had a red shirt on him. You couldn't see him at a political rally. He was given a letter that his contract would not be renewed. Terry Thomas at NDC paid off $168,000 and given marching orders. Diane Auger in Beaufort at the NHC office dismissed within weeks. Linus Marshall at Point Serafin given marching orders. Mullin Samuel, a timekeeper on a project, given marching orders. But there is a deafening silence. A deafening silence, Madam Speaker. Not even from the CSA, which should be protecting its members. Remember the words of Abraham Lincoln. To sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards of men. I will not be silent. I refuse to be silent. The Federation Labour Party will never be silent. Thank you, Madam.